to you by Barfoot and Thompson.
On the show today, we're chatting to the author of Little Addicts, Why We Do What We Do. Find out more. Welcome along to Property Matters. Welcome along to another Monday here. If you're listening live in Auckland, it's a beautiful day after a very wet weekend. Or perhaps you've tuned in, downloaded one of our podcasts, which you can download from Apple and Samsung, iHeartRadio, YouTube, or pretty much anywhere you get your podcasts. Now, first of all, apologies if you tuned in last week. For the first time in 8 seasons, I had a sick day. This flu is doing Auckland bad at the moment. I know so many people clocking up 2-3 weeks with it. As you can probably hear from my voice, it's still there, but I'm really lucky this week because my guest is all the way down in Blenheim, so there's no risk of passing bugs across the studio. But I do want to thank Alex from Martelli Buyers. We've postponed her interview that was due last week. We're going to catch up with her in a few weeks' time in about the middle of August. But today we are talking to the author of Little Addicts. What a fantastic title. Why We Do What We Do. A very big welcome to Corinne. Good afternoon.
Hi, Stephen. Great to be here.
Great to have you. And all the way in Blenheim. And we talked a little bit just before the show, and you're suffering a few power outages down that way today.
Yeah, power outage today, and it's absolutely freezing.
Oh, yes, I didn't think of that. No power, no heaters. Ooh, okay, well, if you start getting out of breath, we know you're just running on the spot to keep warm, and hopefully your cell phone battery gets us through this phone interview. But we really appreciate you coming on and chatting. So, look, let's just give our audience a little bit of a background to who you are. I know you've had a large and varied career journey, so just give us some of those highlights. Who is it that we're talking to?
Yeah, well, Stephen, just feel free to interrupt if I go on.
Oh, we've got plenty of time. Take your time.
I started my career as a registered nurse, and I moved very quickly into nursing education, which I loved. And I taught for 17 years, and then I moved into a management position as a head of department. And I absolutely loved that, doing things like leading teams through huge change projects, writing new degrees, putting degrees online. And I trained as a coach while I was doing that because there was a lot of resistance actually around what I was doing, so I really needed to actually support people to get engaged and get excited. Once I got everything through, got all the accreditations through, I was pretty much in that burnout place, and I was traveling to work one day and my bottom lip started quivering. And I knew, I've got to do something different. So I had a choice. Do I go into senior leadership roles in education, or do I leave and start my own business, my own coaching business? And in my naivety, I left and started my own coaching business. And that was also because I'm totally intolerant of bureaucracy, and there was a lot of bureaucracy in education in those days, and probably still is.
Yes.
And I'm not the kind of person who's going to hold their tongue or put up with that. I'm a get stuff done person. So I decided, yes, I will start my own coaching business, and then immediately contracted back to the business that I'd been working for a very long time. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I supervise coaches. But I think the kind of big change in my career happened when life went belly up, as it sometimes does. And I went through a divorce, and I'd always promised myself when both of my sons left home, I would move to Wellington, because I love Wellington.
Okay.
Absolutely loved it. And I got a job in the corporate world in 2010 as a career management consultant, and also in their talent management arm, so leadership development, if you like. Loved it. And then with a couple of friends created a business called Mindful at Work. They were consultants who ultimately left me on my own. And so I continued with Mindful at Work, writing programs, delivering mindfulness programs in the workplace to businesses. A lot of that was around stress And then in more recent years, after working with my colleague, an absolutely brilliant human being called Michael Bunting, who's a global leadership expert. I've worked mainly in the leadership space, but I've been coaching leaders probably for 20 years in my own coaching business, because even when I was working for somebody else, I was running my own coaching business on the side.
That's cool. So someone listening goes, well, what is coaching and leadership coaching? And look, your CV talks about being a behavioural change specialist. What does that entail?
Yeah, it's a good question. First of all, I coach leaders because leaders have the most impact. And leaders really create the culture of your business and your organisation. So they have the most impact on the business's performance and engagement. And most leadership training teaches leaders what to do. But most leaders know what to do. They just struggle to do it consistently.
Yeah.
So I help leaders change what they do, particularly under pressure. Because under pressure, we don't really rise to our intentions. We just fall back on our conditioning, on our old patterns, on our ways of responding. So I help leaders notice their patterns that quietly hijack them and then replace them with behaviours that build trust, accountability, healthy cultures. So it's not soft stuff. It's really about looking at what impacts the bottom line in a business.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, today we're going to talk about your book, Little Addicts. And for our listeners who hear the word addiction, they can immediately think of, I guess, extreme substance dependencies, etc. Mm. But how do you define little addict in everyday life?
Yeah. Well, exactly what you said. When most people think of addiction, they think of other people. They think of alcoholism or drugs or behaviours like gambling. Gaming.
And it's not me. It's not me. Yeah.
It's not. Yeah. It's other people.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it can just as easily be little addictions like people pleasing, overworking, scrolling, online shopping, perfectionism, staying busy or needing to kind of stay in control. So the book's called Little Addicts because most of us aren't battling those big addictions. We're battling that kind of just one more glass of red wine or just one more email or just one more look at Instagram reels or I'll just keep everyone happy if I do this. So, yeah, that's what I consider Little Addicts is about. And if you look at Gabor Mate's definition of what addiction is, and he's a global expert in addiction, he describes it as any behaviour that gives us temporary relief, pleasure, or satisfies a craving, but causes harm over time. And yet, despite that and the negative consequences, we really struggle to stop it. And, you know, I think that's pretty much all of us. We're all doing something.
Yeah.
For me, it was red wine, among other things. And, you know, I never really considered myself much of a drinker. And then one day I realised at the end of every day I was craving that glass of red wine. And the question wasn't really, am I addicted? Because craving would indicate I certainly was. The important question was, well, hang on, what am I actually looking for here? What do I reach for when life gets uncomfortable? Mm-hmm. And I realised it was relief. And the fascinating thing is, it was just a thought I had when I started writing the book, is, look, we're designed for addiction. We really are. Our brains are evolved to scan for threats and remember what brings relief. So every time something makes us feel better, our brain says, great idea. Let's remember that for next time. Let's do that again. And that's how habits and addictions are formed. You know, the good news is the brain that learned those patterns can learn new ones.
Yeah. So what inspired you to write this book at this time?
Initially, it was walking around the streets of Wellington and around the waterfront and seeing everybody vaping and vape shops popping up
everywhere.
It just happened all of a sudden, and I thought, what is going on? And I remember thinking, I'm going to write a book about vaping, and I mapped it all out, and I had coffee with a journalist author friend of mine, and he looked at what I, you know, the outline of everything, and he got terribly excited, and he could see the commercial value in that. And then when I started doing the research on vaping, I realised that, well, vaping's just the tip of the iceberg. And I was fascinated also by what I saw as a real conundrum, and that is the research is showing that young people are taking up vaping and they've never smoked. So they weren't replacing vaping with, you know, smoking, the nicotine. They weren't replacing that. They were just vaping. And I'm like, oh, what's going on? And that sent me down a real rabbit hole. And I realised that vaping wasn't the story, self-soothing was. And I looked around me and I thought, oh, Lord, we're all sucking on something. In fact, the name of the book initially was going to be You Suck, when it was about vaping. But, you know, we're all sucking on something.
Yeah,
some of us suck on vape pens. Some of us suck on wine.
Yeah.
Some of us suck on work, fun, food, shopping, people-pleasing, control, even being busy, which is a really common distraction. So, you know, 20 years of coaching showed me that incredibly smart people still struggle with behaviours that they know aren't serving them. So different people, different behaviours, but same human brain. So I became fascinated with this question. Why do we keep reaching for things that give us this temporary relief, even though we know they're going to make life harder in the long run? And, I thought, well, the answer really lies in the work that I do in two things, and it's understanding the brain. Our ancient brains evolved to seek relief and avoid pain. And also, most of us are carrying emotional wounds, and if we haven't got emotional wounds and trauma, we've got modern-day pressures, stress, everything that we can, you know, think of. So even if some, you know, people think of trauma and they tend to think of things like abuse or neglect or violence, but most of us have experienced those smaller hurts like rejection, criticism, loss, loneliness, uncertainty, never feeling enough. And or we've experienced things like, I don't know, bullying, divorce, grief, financial stress, or just living under relentless pressure. And I thought, well, you know, the brain doesn't catalogue those experiences as important or unimportant. The brain simply learns what brings relief. So we all experience pain in this life. We just self-soothe in different ways. And Little Addicts is really about understanding our patterns with more curiosity than judgment. So what started as a book about vaping ended up as a book about being human and the work that I do. Yeah.
Brilliant. What's happening in our brains when we do seek those quick fixes? You mentioned, you know, whether it's scrolling social media or impulse buying or endlessly checking our emails or grabbing that glass of wine, red wine by the sounds of it. What is happening in our brains?
Well, that's pretty complex actually, Stephen. So I try to use, you know, simple language to explain what's happening in our brains, and I go into that a lot in the book. But basically, our brain loves efficiency. It remembers what brings quick relief, comfort, and escape. And I like to think of our brains as having two main characters, Homer Simpson and Yoda. Like most people know those characters, and in the book I also refer to them as the reactor and the responder. So I'll talk you through it, and please stop me at any time if it doesn't make sense. But we've got these two brain systems or pathways. One's a fast pathway and one's a slow pathway. Now, your fast pathway, that engages the more primitive brain, and it wants a rapid reflexive response to anything you perceive as a threat. So it's focused on short-term relief, here and now. And its job is safety first. It wants to keep you alive, avoid discomfort, find relief, seek out pleasure. It's fast, but it's not always smart. So I imagine the fast pathway is Homer Simpson. I also call it the reactor in the book. So we all know Homer, and he's the poster child for going for the quick fix. So if you think donuts and beer, he's not all bad, but I doubt many people aspire to be Homer. So that fast pathway is always asking, how can I avoid danger? How can I get rid of discomfort? How can I find pleasure? Just give me the beer, the wine, the food, the Netflix, the cigarettes, the vape, the shoe shopping. That's one of my addictions, shoe shopping. So your fast pathway just also does things like it wants to avoid that difficult conversation. It'll have you saying yes when you really want to say no, or yelling at the kids, or it says to you, go ahead, you know, give that other driver the finger. So the fast brain responses, they feel quite good in the moment because they do provide us with immediate relief, which is why it's so easy to build unhelpful habits that turn into addictions. And then we've got this slow pathway. Now, I imagine the slow pathway, and it involves the prefrontal cortex, you know, your brain CEO, the part that makes us human, the smarter part. I imagine it as being the wiser Yoda, you know, the Jedi master. He's incredibly small, but he is very wise. So I refer to the slow pathway also as the responder in the book. And the slow pathway, because it engages that smarter part of the brain, we need it. We need to bring it online to see the bigger picture, to think logically, for planning, creative problem solving, controlling our urges and regulating our emotions, for adulting, if you like. So these two pathways is not a good one or a bad one. It's not about getting rid of HOMA or anything like that. You could leave them if you wanted to. They do different things. But the slow pathway helps you course correct when HOMA gets things wrong, and it often does. So my work, really, with leaders is supporting them to bring the slower pathway online more often. I also go into the book about our dopamine circuits, because everybody knows dopamine used to be considered the reward chemistry, but it's more anticipation and excitement. So we've got dopamine circuits also, but look, I don't want to go on and on and on about the science. I think if you imagine, you know, just as an example, you've promised yourself that you're not going to check your emails after dinner, then the phone pings and Homer leaps off the couch shouting, quick, it could be important. Whereas if you continue to Yoda, you might find yourself saying, oh, perhaps it could wait to tomorrow, you know?
Or Yoda might have taught you to turn the notifications off.
Might have done, yeah. So Homer wants relief, yeah. Yoda wants what matters most in the long term. So, you know, leaders aren't any different. They don't have different brains. The only difference with leaders is they're different because people live with the consequences of their behaviour.
Look, if I was to refer something you mentioned in the book there, you know, what was the turning point, I guess, when you're working with leaders that made you realise we are all self-soothing in ways we don't even notice?
I couldn't actually say when that turning point was. I think it was, and I just need to give credit where credit is due, I've been working in this area for a long time, but when I actually met Michael Bunting, who met the brilliant Carl Lemoneau. Now, they've written a book called Vertical Growth, which is all about bringing the slow pathway online. And Michael and I were working together and we were writing programs, and Carl got involved and introduced me to acceptance and commitment therapy. Now, acceptance and commitment therapy is all about the fast and slow brain pathways. So, you know, if you're going to write a program on something, you have to learn something, you get that book and you digest it very, very quickly. So everything just fell into place more for me, and I could map it out easily. And it also supported my coaching, because most people know what they want to stop doing and they know what they want to start doing, but they're unaware of the unconscious patterns driving their behavior, and that's why people work with a coach.
Okay. Many of our listeners here are very much real estate agents, property managers, business managers, or business leaders. Now, their jobs naturally have components of friction, whether this is dealing with landlords, angry tenants, emergency repairs, compliance pressures, business pressures. What specific coping mechanisms or little addicts do you see emerge in these high-pressure industries like this?
Yeah. Well, as you know, and as I started our conversation earlier, I'm not an expert in property management or anything like that. I've worked across leadership in just about every other area, I would have to say. And I don't think property managers or any of these people are fundamentally different from the rest of us. They're simply working in an environment with constant pressure, competing demands, and probably a lot of emotionally charged conversations. That's exactly when our little addictions tend to show up, when we're under pressure. So I kind of think property managers probably experiencing things and recognising behaviours like feeling the need to check their emails every few minutes, or feeling they have to respond immediately, or replaying difficult conversations long after they've finished, or working through lunch or taking work home, or lying awake at 3 a.m. thinking about tomorrow's problems, or struggling to switch off because there's always one more thing. So they're probably looking for relief from that pressure, and that's something every profession has in common. So people tend to blame their circumstances on stress and pressure, but actually it's how we interpret, it's how we respond.
Right.
So to what's going on. So you know, it's understanding that our brain is interpreting our circumstances in a particular way, and having the tools to be able to get out of that fast brain reactivity, bring that slow brain online, bring yoga on online, and respond differently.
Is there a trick to bringing yoga online so that we can break that habit of, you know, not answering the emails after work hours?
Yeah, there is. I mean, anybody listening to this conversation is probably going to go, yeah, I need to do that. But it doesn't just magically happen. You have to train it. You have to practice it. You have to consistently, repeatedly do things differently. And that's the space that I work in as a coach. So I support people to do that. It's not a magic pill. You've actually got to repeatedly practice doing things differently, and not everything differently, Stephen. I mean, adult development tells us that it takes 12 to 18 months to change a habit, a pattern, an addiction. It's not a quick fix. You know, we used to think, oh, it takes 6 weeks. No, it does not.
No.
So you need to start with one meaty thing or one small thing and really drill down on it and actually just work on one thing. Because when you work on one thing and you learn how to bring yoga online, it has a domino effect in your life.
I guess it's kind of giving yourself permission too to take your time to get it right. We do live in a world that we want everything done now, and you've just said, you know, it takes time. So you've kind of got to give yourself permission to breathe and practice it, would you say?
Yeah. And I mean, it's not something that people just know how to do. And it's also not something that you can usually do on your own. And that's why, you know, people work with a coach, because it's not just the accountability process that a coach will support the person with. It's actually helping them uncover what their behaviour is serving, because their behaviour is there for a purpose, and it works. And it works, and then it doesn't work. And then it starts to create more problems than it solves. So it's not just a case of stopping. You know what I mean?
So what if I switch from a long-term habit now to, say, being faced with an uncomfortable task? Maybe you need to make a tough phone call to an upset client. How do we push ourselves towards overcoming those tough things that we put off?
Yeah, I'm just... procrastination.
Yep.
Yeah, we all do it.
It's how I got through high school.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, one of the things I notice in my work is predominantly in the leadership space is that we often procrastinate around having difficult conversations. So that's what you want to focus on, Stephen?
Yeah.
So, you know, I just kind of suggest, if you ever notice what happens the day you need to make a really difficult phone call, have that conversation, suddenly, and perhaps more women will relate to this, But suddenly your pantry needs reorganising, or replying to email takes priority, or you remember you've been meaning to ring your mum for 3 weeks, or for reasons you can't explain, it's suddenly the perfect time to clean out the oven. So, you know, you make another coffee, you decide your desk urgently needs tidying. We've all done it. The reason is really simple. Your brain confuses that discomfort with danger. That's Homer's work. You know, he isn't lazy. He's trying to protect you from discomfort. And the problem is you can't tell the difference between an angry tiger and an awkward conversation. So, you know, you'll literally do anything except have that conversation because the conversation is uncomfortable. But avoiding it makes things worse. We all know that. So the trick isn't waiting until you're confident. Confidence usually comes after the conversation. The real skill is recognizing avoidance while it's happening, like in the moment. And asking yourself, am I moving toward what matters or am I moving away from discomfort? So that avoidance gives us that short-term relief, that fast brain reactivity, and that's what Homer wants. But it creates long-term problems for us. We all know this, you know. And when I'm working with leaders, they will often put off those difficult conversations. But I've never had a leader say, I wish I'd waited another 6 months before having that conversation. I should have had that conversation straight away. I should have done it so much sooner.
Well, and difficult things grow with time gaps, you know, and people's angst gets worse both ends. So you're better to deal with it before it becomes even bigger. But yeah, I totally hear what you're saying. I used to reward myself. So I'd go the other way. I'd say, I can't get that coffee or go and clean the desk or anything until I've made the phone call. But then that was kind of like my reward afterwards. Oh, I can go to the cafe now and buy that because I did the phone call. That worked. Switch around. If we turn now to our investors that listen to our show, I'm just wondering how your experience as a behavioural change specialist can help them. For example, investors face interest rate shifts, market dips. Perhaps if they're a landlord, then they get bad tenant news. How do unmanaged emotional reactions lead investors to make impulsive short-term decisions rather than sticking to a long-term goal?
Yeah. Well, as we know, I'm no financial expert.
No. That's
markets
okay.
go up, markets go down, and with them, our emotions. The challenge isn't managing the market. I mean, they all know that. It's managing ourselves. It's managing yourself. So, you know, if the market drops, Homer's immediately shouting, sell, get out, do something, you know. Homer loves action. Whereas Yoda, if you can tune into yoga, perhaps let's not make a 5-year decision that's based on a 5-minute feeling. So before your mind starts telling you stories, and remember, it's safety first, listen to your body. Your body, you know, are your shoulders tight? Is your stomach in knots? Your heart rate up? Is your breathing shallow? Because that's your nervous system saying, well, something doesn't feel safe here. And then your mind will start feeding it fear. What if it gets worse? Everyone else is selling. Maybe I should do something. And that's that fast brain reactivity. Now, the trick isn't to ignore those feelings. Is to notice them. Because that awareness creates some choice, some space, you know. Feelings are data. They're not directives. So your emotions are saying, pay attention. But they're not necessarily saying, take immediate action. So that's probably the most important thing, how to manage ourselves through the ups and downs.
So you don't need to be a financial advisor to help us. Perfect. Perfect answer. Do you find that media coverage triggers strong emotional responses? You know, our little addicts coming out in to react to that fear of missing out or that panic thing based on what they're hearing in the media?
Yeah. I mean, fear of missing out isn't new. It's ancient. And it's based in our history of missing out once could be life-threatening. Today, if it's missing out on investing or worrying everybody else knows something you don't, Homer hates that, hates missing out. He also hates losing. So our minds constantly run into imagined kind of futures. What if I lose everything? What if everyone else gets rich except for me? And that's not reality. That's our negativity bias. acting up, you know, trying to protect us. So the media knows this. Printing everything is wonderful, everything's fine, doesn't sell newspapers or social media. So when markets fall, Homer doesn't just see the information, he sees danger. Then social media pours petrol on that, and then suddenly everyone's buying or everyone's selling. And before long, we're not responding to the market, we're just responding to everyone else's emotions. And I guess that's how bubbles happen, panic selling. But, you know, Yoda quietly reminds us, don't mistake noise. Whether you're investing, whether you're leading a business or whatever, long-term success usually looks wonderfully boring. It's built on consistency. So it's about, you know, sticking to your principles, sticking to your values, sticking to your long-term plan, really.
How do you think your book would help perhaps investors or property managers, you know, those listening to us today? What do you think would be their takeaways?
I think the key takeaways would be really understanding emotional decision-making for those people, getting to recognise their triggers. And you do that through increasing self-awareness and becoming less reactive, becoming more like Yehuda, if you like. So better investing really starts with better self-management, is what I would say, just to keep that answer quite succinct.
Okay, if we think about our audience of property managers, can we walk through a real-time scenario? So a property manager's just received a hostile email from a tenant, their heart rate's up, they want to react immediately. What is a 60-second circuit breaker tool they can use to just pause and respond mindfully instead of reactively?
Yeah, I call it the three N's. Notice, name, need. So I'll walk you through it. So first of all, you've got to pause. Because if you can't pause, you're lost in fast brain reactivity. Homer's in charge. So you the first N is notice. What's happening in my body? Is my heart racing? My jaw tight? Mm-hmm. You know, am I holding my breath? Notice what your mind is up to, because it will feed that reactivity. So that's the first thing. Notice, pause, notice what's going on. Second thing is name. What am I actually feeling? Name the emotion. Am I angry, defensive, embarrassed, hurt, frustrated? Once we name the emotion, it begins to lose some of its grip. It takes us out of that old, fast, primitive brain and into that slower, smarter prefrontal cortex. So naming the emotion is an incredibly powerful thing to do. And then the third N is need. What do I need right now? Do I need to reply immediately? Do I need 5 minutes, 5 hours, or should I wait until tomorrow? So you're asking yourself that question, what do I need, more from a Yoda perspective than a Homer. It's not, you don't need another glass of wine. you need to think long term, yeah.
So, I like it. Notice, name, and need. Try it, property managers. Let us know. Once we identify a little addict behaviour in ourselves, whether it's doom scrolling when stressed or overeating after a hard day at work, what is the process for replacing it with a healthier habit without feeling deprived? Especially, as you said, because it can take time.
It can really take time. I mean, I think one of the biggest mistakes we make, Stephen, is just trying to remove the habit. Mm. The better question, I touched on that before, is what job is this habit doing? What relief is it providing? So it's actually the solution to something that you need to name. So every habit, every addiction, it serves a purpose. So it might be relieving stress or reducing loneliness, or avoiding rejection, or helping us stay in control. If we're not careful, and if we don't investigate the need that it's serving, then we'll just likely replace one unhelpful habit with another. So the goal here isn't about deprivation, but it is about substitution. It is about replacing it with a healthier habit that meets the same need. And please don't try and change everything on Monday morning. Don't try and change your whole life. Start ridiculously small, because tiny changes repeated consistently beat grand plans that'll be abandoned by Wednesday. So, yeah, don't just remove the habit, replace the need, and get really curious and let go of the self-criticism. You're not broken. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not flawed. You're human. Mm. And this is what humans do. Yeah.
Brilliant. For leaders listening, how can they build a work environment that doesn't rely on the burnout culture to get results?
Yeah, I think the answer that I would go with there is remember that you are role modelling everything. And burnout isn't caused by one bad week. It's created by thousands of tiny signals that we usually ignore. So leads your role modelling even when you don't realise it. People notice when the boss emails at midnight.
Yeah.
They notice if their leaders are not taking leave. They notice if people are being praised for being exhausted. Culture isn't created by the values on the wall. It's created by the behaviours people see every day. And healthy leaders really give people permission to rest, to ask for help, to disagree respectfully, to switch off and to have difficult conversations before problems become crises.
Mm.
So, I think I'd just say to leaders, people copy your behaviour more than they follow policies. Just like in parenting.
Yeah, totally. Now, look, you've got your own podcast as well. Tell me about that and where can people tune into that one?
Yeah, well, the podcast is the same name, Little Addicts, and I started it because I got partway through the book and I thought, oh, I've got all these experts. I know I could interview them for the book. And I had so much fun, I stopped writing. So I had to stop the podcast and then finish the book. So the book and the podcast are really designed to give people hope and add a bit of levity. The book and the podcast answers three questions. Why do I do what I do? Why can't I stop even when I really want to? And how do I turn things around?
Nice.
I have had great fun doing that podcast. And it's really just about understanding that we're all trying to feel better. The question isn't whether you have a little addiction, because most of us have. The question is whether the things you do to feel better are helping you build the life you want or quietly pulling you away from it. And the good news is that once we notice the pattern, that's really important, we're no longer completely trapped by it.
Where can people find your podcast?
On all the usual places. Apple, Spotify, I think it's on iHeartRadio as well. Or just go to my website, mindfulatwork.co.nz, or lowercase. Yeah.
Now, this isn't your first book. You've written a few others before this. Is there another book in the making at the moment?
Well, people have asked me that. Yeah, I wrote Crazy Busy. If busy is the new stupid, then mindful is the new smart. That was released just when COVID hit. Not a good time to launch a book. and I have written other books, but there are lots of personal stories in this book, Little Addicts, because, I mean, people don't want to read about the little addictions we all have from somebody who's perfect. So I bring a lot of my own story in there, and also I talk about my own background with things that didn't go terribly well in my childhood or relationships, stress and things like that. And I think my third book will need to wait until some of my family members are no longer around.
Oh, I love that. Where can people pick up a copy of the book, or perhaps, again, repeat your website to reach out for you for Mindful at Work, because you can obviously go in and work and coach leaders. So how can they get in touch?
Yeah, I'd love to talk to you. So basically you can buy the book or just book a call with me to talk to me either personally about leadership coaching or coaching your leaders or coaching your teams. Just at my website, mindfulatwork.co.nz.
Fantastic. Corinne, we've run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you get power on tonight to be able to cook your dinner in Blenheim. And we appreciate your time on Property Matters tonight.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody. We are out of time. We will catch you next Monday. Have a fabulous week. Drive home safely. And remember, you can always email us, propertymatters@barfoot.co.nz. Good night, everyone.
really matters.